Dear Lord, we're about to discuss issues that are not unimportant. They really are reaching us where we live today, the conditions of the world around us, but more importantly, what is happening within your church. And we just ask that your Holy Spirit be here, and that I just disappear. And we just pray that whatever is said here today be totally in your hands and in consequence of your will. In Jesus' name, amen. And our topic this afternoon is end time events. Out in the world, but more importantly, here within the church. Because it seems quite clear that some of the most spectacular examples that will draw our attention to the fact that Jesus is coming soon occur not out there in the world, but inside where God's work is progressing. And so we'll talk about end time events starting with the world, but we'll soon discover you can't look very long at end time world events without seeing events within the church. It's almost like two railroad tracks. They don't disappear very far into the distance before they seem to merge and become one. And truth and error sometimes are the same, particularly within the church. Error can lie so close beside the track of truth that in the distance they seem to merge and become one. And very persuasive voices can sometimes lead us astray. And that's what I pray we will become aware of this afternoon. Let's talk first about events in the world. We're going to discuss three major world events that I think have end time implications. And the first one is the world economy, and I invite your attention to Revelation chapter 18. We'll start with verse 11. We'll skip down kind of toward verse 17. And the merchants of the earth will weep and mourn, for no one buys their merchandise anymore. Gold and silver, precious stones, every kind of object, all the things which are rich and splendid have gone. Now moving down toward verse 17, the merchants stand at a distance saying, "Alas, alas, for in 1 hour so great riches came to nothing." And the Greek word there is ora, which doesn't mean a literal hour or a prophetic hour. It means a very short, indeterminate period of time. That's the same Greek word that is used later on in connection with the time of trouble, which tells us the time of trouble doesn't last long, and praise the Lord for that. I don't think we should fixate on the time of trouble as we prepare for the end of time. That'll take care of itself. Let's fixate on getting to know the Lord. He'll get us through the time of trouble. But what John describes here in Revelation 18 obviously has world trade implications, because you go on and notice here that it says, "Every shipmaster and as many as trade by sea stood at a distance wailing, in 1 hour she's made desolate." This has implications for world trade. Now, what the Bible paints as an end-time economic picture is not a pretty one. Nor are the few predictions made in the spirit of prophecy. There aren't a lot of them there, because the Bible and spirit of prophecy are not intended to be an end time done in Bradstreet. We don't plan our investments in accordance with that, except to reflect on the words of Jesus, who said the only really safe place to put your wealth is in the work. Every place else, there are risks. Now, Ellen White took these revelation concepts and annotated or enlarged on them very fascinatingly. One quotation that I found as I was looking for a hint in her writings, the possibility of hyperinflation at the end of time, occurred in a little pamphlet called The True Missionary. It was published in January 1 of 1874, and she put it this way: "Money will soon depreciate in value very suddenly." What is that? That's the collapse of a monetary system. Another term for that is hyperinflation. money loses value, but it does it very rapidly. Now, when does this happen? Well, she goes on to say, it loses value very suddenly when the reality of eternal scenes opens to the senses of man. In other words, this happens when we are on the brink of eternity, and even the non-believers are beginning to get it. The reality of eternal scenes is opening to the world population. Something goes wrong. The Laffer curve goes really askew. Our monetary system begins to collapse, and we are beginning to recognize hyperinflation. Well, there's another broad hint of hyperinflation, and you can find that one in a more easily accessible source. That is Maranatha, page 173. Maranatha is really an outstanding book. I just encourage people to read that thing till it wears out and go buy another copy and start reading again. Page 173, she said, "The Lord has shown me that some of His children would fear when they see the price of food rising. And they would buy food and lay it by for the time of trouble." Now, we've all seen the price of food rise. I can remember when bread was 30 cents a loaf. It's now $4 or $5 a loaf. We've all seen the price of food rise. But not with that exponential upswing of the curve that produces fear. We feel annoyance now. We don't have fear yet. She says the time will come and we'll feel fear. And that's when Mom says to Dad, "You know, you better get your pocket knife out, cut open the mattress, get the money out, and we better buy something before this stuff is worth nothing but wallpaper." So she said some of God's children go and trade their money for food because money obviously is losing its value. Now, it's obvious that when this happens, the world is starting to go bad. You can begin to see real trouble coming where money is going to simply not be of use anymore. There is still time, however, for it to rot. Because the next sentence, she says, in the time of trouble, when they went and got this food they had bought, it had bred worms and was full of living creatures and wasn't fit for use. So there's enough time between the moment when fear sets in and people try to begin to prepare for the time of trouble until it actually arrives for food to rot. Don't know how long that is, but it goes bad. Her point is, the time of trouble is not a time for us to proudly look up to heaven and say, "Well, Lord, we got it all covered here. We've got plenty of food. You know, we'll just sit here in relative ease and await your coming." The function of the time of trouble is to pull our claws out of a world we are very reluctant to turn loose of. It almost reminds me of the cat. When I was early in my broadcast career, our studios were next to a restaurant, two-story building, and I was going in for an early morning broadcast shift, and I heard this pathetic meow from the roof of that restaurant. And I could see how that tomcat got up there. There was a long ladder going up there. Well, I happen to like animals, so I climbed the ladder and I called the cat, and he came over just purring and talking to me. It all went well till I tried to take him off the roof. And then he held onto that roof with every claw he had, just like us. We want to get off this world and we're afraid to turn loose of it. And I think the function of the time of trouble is to pry our fingernails out of this world and simply recognize there's nothing left here for us and our only hope is getting off this world straight up and giving it to the Lord. So some of God's children develop concern when they see the price of food rising. And when that happens, when the price of food rises rapidly enough, thank you so much, rises rapidly enough for people to feel fear, that's hyperinflation. Now, you see the common theme in the Bible and the spirit of prophecy: financial collapse and hyperinflation. Now, let's talk about the world events at the end of time and the economy. Today, America owes something like $17 trillion, and it's going up because we increase that by $2.5 billion every single day. Which, to appreciate, we need to understand how much $1 trillion is. Well, it's real simple. If you took $100 bills and stacked them up in banker's boxes. You know those boxes about 10 inches high. Filled them full of $100 bills. You could entirely fill a football field out into the sidelines, clear off the playing field, with banker's boxes filled with $100 bills. You could fill the Rose Bowl or the Cotton Bowl 10 inches deep with $100 bills out into the sidelines. If you chose to represent that debt with $1 bills, they'd be as high as an 8-story building. We owe 17 football fields, 83 feet deep, in dollar bills, which is more enough to fill more than half of the stadiums in the entire National Football League. I mean, we're talking, for example, filling MetLife Stadium, Cowboy Stadium, Mile High, Sun Life, Candlestick Park, Georgia Dome, Heinz Field, the Oakland Coliseum, Soldier Field, and Qualcomm Stadium down in San Diego, and we would still have 7 more stadiums to go filled 83 feet deep with borrowed money. And we owe a chunk of that to whom? People's Republic of China. So what on earth are we going to do? Well, we got 3 ugly choices, any one of which is guaranteed to lead to a very bad end game. Let's go through them. Number one, to address this problem of the deficit, we could raise taxes. That's the one politicians oftentimes go to first. That's the one they think of first. And that'll work until we are rudely made aware that if every high-income taxpayer in America paid 100% of their income, it would only fund the government for a very few short weeks. If we did that, probably the 50% of the people who don't effectively pay taxes now would also have to chip in some way, because there's got to be enough money there to deal with the problem. They would discover that paying taxes isn't the biggest thrill you feel all year long. Now, I'm a tax attorney. I represent people all the time, some of whom have just basically encountered a problem because of the declining economy, and they run afoul of issues with both the IRS and California taxing agencies. The third probability is that if we were to divert that much money to the public sector out of the private sector, we could effectively bring to a halt any economic growth or recovery we hope we're having. So raising taxes just might not do it. That takes us down to choice number two. We'll just take the national Visa card to the Persian Gulf and the Bank of China and basically walk up to the teller's window and say, Uncle Sam needs a little more sugar. That will work until the teller, with an embarrassed smile, said, very sorry, but your credit card's been declined. Or it'll work until we get into a good hot fight over Asian sea lanes or Southeast Asian oil. And that could happen. I don't know if you noticed it, but not too long ago this year, the People's Republic of China and the Russian Republic engaged in joint military exercises. Those old Cold War allies are rediscovering each other, and it's beginning to dawn on them it isn't always going to be sweetness and light. So borrowing money may not solve the problem. That leaves us with option number 3. And that looks like this. Now, that's real money. I didn't do this on our office Xerox machine. I bought this from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. These are uncut $1 bills. The third option, which is frequently resorted to by governments which have the power to create money, which none of the rest of us do, is to simply say, if there's not enough cash in the system, let's create it. Now, the Federal Reserve does this by injecting those ones and zeros into the system, into the electronic system that declares that money has been created. Bureau of Engraving and Printing, the Treasury, then responds by issuing this stuff. And presto, you've solved the problem, because there's the money to pay the debt with. That'll work until when? until the supply of money gets to be so large that too many dollars are chasing a fixed amount of goods in the marketplace. And what happens to the price of goods? It goes up, and the price of money does what? It comes down. Supply and demand takes over. That is inflation. Let it take off too rapidly, and it's hyperinflation. Now, here's the problem that we face. Right now, what passes for an economic recovery is basically funded by the Federal Reserve, by our creation of money. So what we're doing is we're stimulating a global recovery here, to some extent, by creating money out of nothing. And earlier this year, Warren Buffett, at a National Economic Summit conference, said, if the Fed quits doing this, if the Fed quits creating money, it will be the shot heard round the world. We don't dare, in a sense, quit creating money, but here's the other half of that equation. Keep printing it too long, and what happens? We're riding a tiger. The risk of riding a tiger is get off too soon and the tiger may eat you. Stay on too long and it carries you back to a whole nest of tigers who can eat you. If you keep printing money, you will ultimately encounter hyperinflation. Now, that was discovered by the German Reichstag after World War I. The Allies had imposed on them such tremendous war reparations. The war-shattered German economy just couldn't create that kind of wealth, so they started printing money. That's the only thing they could think of to do. That's option number three. What happened to the mark is interesting. In 1919, $1 would buy 12 marks, reasonably good rate of exchange. A little over 2 years later, $1 would buy 263 marks. Now you start to see the price of food doing what? Rising. Somewhere along that accelerating curve, at the end of time, some of God's people will begin to feel fear and they'll try to convert dollars or money into usable goods. 2 years after that, in 1923, $1 would buy 4.6 million marks. And by Christmas of 1924, the whole thing had come down around their ears. $1 was worth 4.2 trillion marks. By that time, the mark was so worthless, it just wasn't worth ink for both sides of a piece of paper. They only printed the marks on one side, and here is an example of that. I hunted for years to get a hold of one of these things. This is a million mark note from 1923. It's printed on one side. On the other, there is nothing. Because it wasn't worth the ink. Now, what happened then was that German citizens would pile a wheelbarrow full of this worthless stuff, take it down to the bakery and get a loaf of bread with it. You've seen these pictures. You've heard these illustrations. And the story that I often tell is how Heinrich and his wife were headed for the bakery to buy a loaf of bread with a wheelbarrow piled full of this kind of paper. And Heinrich gets to the bakery and just parks the wheelbarrow on the sidewalk. His wife says, Heinrich, you're crazy. Somebody will steal that. He says, hey there, nobody's going to steal that. It's too worthless. He was right. They came back out to get the money to pay for the loaf of bread. The money was in a heap. Somebody had stolen the wheelbarrow. That is hyperinflation. That's when the curve goes vertical, when you have a monetary collapse, your currency collapses. Now, that isn't limited just to 1920s Germany. It's happened recently in the African nation of Zimbabwe. And I've got in my hand here 10 $100 trillion Zimbabwean notes. For some reason, they're still printing this on both sides. I guess ink has gotten less expensive. Anyway, I guess I own what? A quadrillion Zimbabwean dollars. This whole handful of money could be purchased for 15 cents. Now, the sad thing is Zimbabwe never needed to go there. They're a wealthy nation in terms of natural resources. They have talented people. Back in 1980, when they got their independence, their dollar was worth more than a U.S. dollar. So what went wrong? Well, in 1991, the International Monetary Fund came along with a brilliant idea, a really brainy idea called structural adjustment of their currency. When governments get involved in doing things that private people normally do, it doesn't often end well. This one didn't. There began to be wealth distribution. Land began to be redistributed from those who knew how to farm to those who didn't know how to farm. The agricultural system of the country collapsed. Employment went to 80%, and the reasons were three. Number one, there was no basis for the currency. It wasn't based on anything but just promises. Number two, they were printing their money to finance a war. Oh, wait a second, aren't we? Number three, people lost faith in the currency. Now, let's go over those. Number one, there was no basis for their currency. Well, let me show you something. Back before my lifetime, but not that far back, a $10 bill looked like this. American $10 bill looked like this. Look at the backside. What color is it? Kind of yellow, which stands for gold. And this piece of money says, this certifies there has been deposited in the Treasury of the United States $10 in gold coin payable to the bearer on demand. You could trade this piece of paper for something that had $10 worth of intrinsic value. Well, time went by. There wasn't enough gold to fund the growing economy, I guess. So we then switched to a new iteration of this same thing. This is a $5 bill, but at the top it says silver certificate, which basically says the United States of America will pay to the bearer in silver on demand $5. So you could once again trade this for something that had intrinsic value. Now our money looks very similar, except the little seal's in a different color. And at the top it says Federal Reserve Note, which expressed in more common terminology would be IOU. It's based on nothing except our confidence that this system works. And so far it has. This system has produced the most fabulous economy in the history of the world. It can work until what? Until you print too many of these things. And then the value of money comes down. So what happened in Zimbabwe is eerily reminiscent of what we're going through now. No basis for the currency, printing money to finance a war, and ultimately people lost faith in the money they were spending. And tragic results happened to a country that deserved better. Three ugly choices: raise taxes, borrow money, or print money. None of them have a lot of promise in them, and get this clear, we're using all three of them now. And how's that working out for us? I cannot see from where I sit looking at the system anything ultimately but a train wreck. Something is going to happen. It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I don't welcome that. I don't look forward to it. I love this country. I've fought under its flag. I know what it sounds like to hear return fire whizzing over your head from an angry enemy. I don't wish ill upon the United States, but I hate to see happening what could happen if this process continues. So the first issue in end time events and prophecy is the economy. And the Apostle James doesn't give us a whole lot of reassurance. In James 5, chapter 1, he says, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl. Your miseries are coming upon you. Your riches are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and silver are corroded." Now, gold and silver can't corrode. Gold doesn't react with anything except in a very, very powerful combination of two acids. Otherwise than that, it's just inert. Gold and silver can't do what James is describing unless the laws of chemistry change. Or, to use the metaphor a little more clearly, unless toward the end of time the laws of economics change and nothing we've ever done before seems to work any longer. So that brings us back to the advice of Jesus. What did he say? Put your money where moth and rust can't get at it, and where thieves don't break through and steal. Now, having said all that, I want to caution us that we don't go off and do things ill-advised and run ahead of the Lord. People sometimes do those kinds of things. Put your money on the altar, put your future on the altar, and let the Lord direct the future. Don't run off hysterically and just do something, because if we do that, we can't see the future and we're apt to make a very bad mistake. All I'm saying is let the Lord lead. Very important that we do that. So the first issue in end time events is the economy, and I wish I didn't have to say this, but I don't see an easy end to this problem. Point number two is one that I don't know that I've ever addressed this explicitly in any public presentation, but I think it's time to say it. And that is the secular drift and moral collapse of our society. Another end time issue. Beginning to happen with increasing geometric progression. It's speeding up. It's accelerating. Everywhere you look, from court decisions to legislative changes to just the behavior of the individual on the street, or, may I say, the behavior of men running for public office, all suggests there's a moral collapse in our society. We had a while back bumper stickers in California that said, it's 11 p.m., do you know where your congressman is? Something else that bothers me is the broadcasts that pass for news reporting, but are really advocacy. I say that advisedly. I was in broadcast news before I became a lawyer, and let me just tell you, when you watch the news, you don't always get the news. Just take it from me. So everywhere you look, the values that we've believed in seem to kind of be in the meat grinder, even in the language you hear on the street or in many offices. I've been shocked, practicing law downtown L.A. for quite a while, at the language I would hear from ladies in a law office. It is the kind of thing I used to hear from sailors on the quarterdeck of a warship. And it reminds me of the story of the old gentleman who got on an elevator in a high-rise building. He had a hat on. He was really old school. A couple of young women got on the elevator, and he took his hat off. There were ladies present. But the elevator just stopped at every floor, 5 through 30. Finally, one of the young women just had enough of it. She burst out, blankety-blank, this blankety-blank elevator. And the old man didn't say anything. He just put his hat back on his head. What we're seeing in our society these days just doesn't reflect our values in many respects. Traditional family, hard work, honesty, decent language, and common courtesy. And more often, this unwelcome thought kind of steals into the world of consciousness. This is not the country I thought I knew. Something's going wrong. All of which brings to mind a prediction made by Jesus. Now, in Luke 17:2, Jesus kind of described a societal problem just before his coming. He said, as it was in the days of Lot, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. We might add they did something else, because where did Lot live? Place called Sodom. And sad to say, the guys in Sodom had a problem. They had an obsession. And it wasn't with honesty, decency, hard work, or the traditional family. Their obsession was very different. It was so intense that even when supernaturally struck blind, they couldn't get over that obsession. They had one thing on their minds, and it wasn't Lot's daughters. Okay? And there came a time when heaven just had enough. And one afternoon, up there on the Judean Heights, here's this old man of faith sitting in the door of his tent, and three apparently human travelers come wandering down the road, and he bows low and invites them in. I so appreciate Middle Eastern hospitality. It's just unequaled anywhere on earth. And I was at a drugstore recently, and the man who was waiting on me was obviously Arabic. And So, using the little bit of Arabic that I know, I just said to him, Marhaba. And he instantly did this and said, Shukran. You know, just the courtesy and decency one finds in the Middle East, even though it has its share of problems, is kind of refreshing. And Abraham does that, and these three visitors come and begin to disclose to him, something's wrong down there. We're going down and have a look. And in the book Lucifer Diary, I paint a word picture of the view that Abraham may have had the next morning from the Judean heights. Those pillars of superheated gas coming up into the air. And any time you do that from a conventional high explosive to nuclear, it comes up in a column and it finally reaches a point where the atmosphere can't sustain the rising column of air and it blossoms out into a mushroom cap. And Abraham must have seen something like that. Pillars of fire coming up off the desert. And the question is, do we hear echoes of Sodom today in our society? What about the traditional family, where kids once heard truths read every morning and every evening from the Bible by a mom and a dad, and went to church each Sunday, and learned to work and treat elders with respect and say yes, sir, and no, ma'am, and count honest change at the cash register? Might a weary majority finally one day say, yeah, we remember those days. Enough is enough. It's time to get America back. You imagine that happening? Well, hear me well. The secular drift of our society suggests that when hard times come, and they will, a frightened and fed up majority will suddenly remember that back in the good old days, when families were together and people were in church on Sunday and you could get on an elevator without hearing somebody say something nasty, things were better. Now, when a frightened majority finally rediscovers the need for old-fashioned morality and the only hope of survival seems to be a return to the good old days, can you imagine how angry people would be if a little minority refuses to join the majority back to an enforced moral America over something as arbitrary as a day of worship? Can you imagine that happening? Well, listen to Great Controversy, page 591. Those who honor the Bible Sabbath will be denounced as enemies of law and order, as breaking down the moral restraints of society, causing anarchy. What does that tell you? There's a time out there, that period of time that Daniel saw and described in Daniel 12, where everything falls apart and anarchy is the rule. It's the rule of the sword and the gun, the survival of the strongest. Things go bad, order doesn't exist anymore, and God's people get blamed for it. Anarchy's out there. If it weren't, how could we be blamed for it? So when the storm comes, and it will come, failed liberalism might provoke a backlash, rarely if ever seen in history. All of which leads us then to topic number 3 of world events, and that is loss of liberty. Now think about this. Frightened people classically surrender liberty. They just throw it away. Best example of that is frightened Germans after the collapse of their currency threw all of their dreams and fears into a cauldron named Adolf Hitler. By the way, you realize that Hitler wasn't his real name? Did you know that? His birth name was Schickelgruber. It's quite obvious he felt the need to change it. I mean, Heil Schickelgruber just doesn't sell. But frightened Germans bought into a demagogic line by a very, very powerful, very, very articulate spokesman. Get good and scared, and liberty goes overboard like Jonah. Now, with that in mind, think about this. Every email, every tweet, every phone call you make is on a party line. Do you know that? Not just your cell phones. We've now learned that the transoceanic fiber optic cables that you might think would be secure because they got 5 miles of water above them are also being monitored and observed and retained by equipment we barely understand and by people we don't even know. But that ain't all. We've now learned that all mail that you send through snail mail is photographed as to the address portion of your envelope, and that is saved. And I understand the government's concern about dealing with this undercurrent of terrorism in our world. I'm not unsympathetic, or I don't fail to understand the government's needs, but what I'm saying is that frightened people and frightened governments tend to throw liberty away. And I strongly caution you, when you get on the phone to your grandchild and say, oh, little Johnny, Grandma and Grandpa are so anxious to see you next summer. You're going to have fun staying with us. We live in a big white house. Stop it right there. Those last two words have guaranteed that that conversation will be diverted over for further examination. Why? Because you've used a term often associated with national leadership. That's how sensitive it can be. Frightened people and frightened governments discard liberty. A few years ago, we thought the biggest danger we faced in this world, both in terms of existential survival and for the work of God, came from an entity, a monolith we call the Soviet Union. I was in broadcast news. I reported both the Cuban Missile Crisis and the death of JFK, which, by the way, this year is the 50th year after November 22. I still have in my personal possession all of the United Press teletype papers reporting the assassination, all the way from the first shots being fired to confirmation of his death to what followed then. I've never seen a collection as complete as mine this side of the Smithsonian. I just pulled them off the UPI wire and I kept them. They're getting kind of old and yellow, but here are the UPI news teletypes from the Cuban Missile Crisis. This is the one where I broke into a broadcast and I said, we interrupt this broadcast for a bulletin from the wires of United Press International. President Kennedy disclosed tonight that Russian arms have turned Cuba into a clearly offensive base capable of delivering destruction into the heart of America. Well, I was on the air that whole couple of weeks, 21 days, whatever it lasted, reporting this thing. Back in those days, here we are facing this monolithic organization called the Soviet Union, which seemed to stand not only for a physical risk to our survival as a nation, but it also was a huge wall between us and doing what? Finishing the work of God. Okay? I well remember when Joelle and I first went to Moscow back in the Soviet days. We went to the church, the central church down in downtown Moscow. And I had brought into Russia, into the Soviet Union, a Russian language version of Ministry of Healing, Zhizhenny Zdorovye. And I'm thinking to myself, how do I get this to the right person? Well, they escorted us down near the front, near the pulpit. And in the Moscow church, at least then, the church didn't have money enough to supply hymnals like we do here, so everybody brought their own. And we stood up to sing, and a nice lady behind me offered her hymnal. Well, I could read Russian, so I went through the motions of what passes for singing, but you wouldn't want to listen to it. Anyway, I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. This church congregation will have agents from Komitet Gosudarstvennyye Bezpečnosti, the KGB, and they're going to be watching. How do I get this book to somebody? And it came to me, look, just put it under the hymn book and hand it back to this lady. That's as good as you're going to do. Well, I did that. But in an act of just total naive innocence, she pulls it out, looks at it, blows me a kiss. And at that point, KGB knew something was going on because we got hassle leaving Moscow. Anyway, I got to thinking, who is this that the Lord has directed me to give this book to? And I turned around and I whispered to her, "Vrach, are you a doctor?" And she said, "Da, ja, Vrach." I had given it to a doctor. Well, a few years went by and I was back in the Russian Republic speaking from the pulpit of the Moscow church. When I got done, among the parishioners coming out was a guy who was a major in the Russian Air Force. He was a pilot. I'm a pilot too. And we compared notes for a moment. We discovered we were of comparable rank. And there in the doorway of the Moscow church, he and I exchanged a good old-fashioned Russian bear hug. Two guys who in another lifetime would have been looking at each other over gun sights, but were brothers in the Lord. And I thought to myself, look how it's changed. For a while, it seemed as if this monolith was in our way. How's the work of God going to get done? But ladies and gentlemen, when heaven determines it's time to move forward and open opportunities, miracles happen. We didn't have to worry too long about how we're going to finish the work of God. We were reminded there's still a king on the throne. The mighty Soviet Union, with its 50,000 main battle tanks across Germany's Fulda Gap, and its some 40,000 nuclear weapons, just disappeared with hardly a whimper. And suddenly, what happened? The world stood open. There was this huge hole in Lucifer's defensive line. If ever there were a signal for a soon coming advent, this was it. As if there was this peal of cosmic trumpet sounding, charge! Now, in war, when enemy lines break, you don't stare at them, you don't stroll through, you run through. One thing you don't do in combat is to sit around admiring opportunity, because it ain't going to be there very long. There's this frightened, very active enemy trying to plug the holes, trying to get things under control. And in the great controversy war, we're not facing a human general capable of making human mistakes. There's no fog of war with General Lucifer. And when he confronts a problem like this, he counterattacks and he does it with incredible fury. And what was about to happen in the decade of the 1990s is astonishingly similar to an event at the start of the 20th century, nearly 100 years before. And I'm going to take a few moments of your time to go through that, because you're going to see there's a lesson here. The same events, the same issues were in play both times. Then, in 1900 as in 1990, the world stood mysteriously open. Not for long. The opportunity did not last long, but it was mysteriously open for the finishing of God's work. Then, as in the 1990s, there was a sudden mysterious prosperity. In other words, I believe in 1900, Jesus was trying to return. And Ellen White, a year later, was giving the warning, he wants to come soon, he could have come before now, get working, because if we are insubordinate, we're going to be in this world a lot of years. See, in 1900, heaven had already given the church the 1888 message. Now, let me stop for just a second on that. I know a lot of ink has been spilled on the 1888 message. A lot of opinions have been expressed. Let me give you my thoughts on it very simply. I think what 1888 stood for was the Lord was trying to get Jesus back into the center of everything we teach. Now, it's very easy these days to say, oh, our doctrines don't matter. Just have a relationship with Jesus. And that can sound very persuasive if it's cleverly portrayed from up here in the pulpit. Be careful of that. Because Jesus doesn't exist in the abstract. He is the center of what? Of every valuable end-time doctrine we preach. People say, I don't want to bother me with the sanctuary, the investigative judgment. I don't believe there is a judgment. All of that sounds real good from up here until you stop to think about what Jesus is doing now. He's involved in the judgment. We're going to talk about that in a few moments. But what he's doing is securing absolutely your assurance of getting to heaven. We begin to say that I want to see Jesus, I don't care about the doctrines. What we're saying is Jesus doesn't exist in those doctrines, and those are the way we see him toward the end of time. He's the center of everything we preach. If we don't put Jesus in the center of everything, from healthful living, through the judgment hour message, through the Sabbath, through the warning we're supposed to give to the world about an end-time mistake called the Mark of the Beast, and the capstone in Revelation 14:12 of people who keep the commandments of God and have the faith of Jesus, If we don't put him in the center of everything we preach, we will attract people, we'll convert them, and we will have made biblically literate, prophetically aware, probably healthier sinners. You put Jesus back in as I think was intended in 1888. You combine that with the mighty Holy Spirit power out of the morning of creation, and you have a message that can alter human history. And I think what the Lord was trying to do toward the turn of the century back as 1900s began was to take the mighty message of 1888, put Jesus back recognizably, prominently in the center, make him the axle around which every one of these unique, necessary end-time doctrines turn, and you can alter history, and you don't have to be on this world that much longer. So I was convinced that at the turn of the 20th century, 1900 or thereabouts, Jesus was trying to return. In 1981, I wrote a little book called Omega. By the way, when I was back at ASI, C.D. Brooks said to me, you know, I so appreciated that book, would you sign one and send it to me? And I did. I got back the sweetest letter from that old saint. I just admire him so much. And the book Omega began on New Year's Day in 1900, where nearly everywhere you looked there was peace. Go almost anywhere on earth. And as the new century dawned, there was also this huge wave of prosperity. Everywhere you looked, people were making money. One newspaper editor in New York said, if you couldn't make money last year, you better get out of business. That was the case not only out in the world, but in the church. The brilliant Kellogg brothers, John Harvey Kellogg, the doctor, and his brother Will Keith, W.K. Kellogg. Have you ever seen that name, by the way? Like on a breakfast cereal box? Those two brothers, following insights given them in the spirit of prophecy, had taken our health message and the breakfast food industry to a pinnacle where there was so much wealth, you could have finished the work of God easily in the world. And our great sanitarium at Battle Creek drew captains of industry, presidents, European royalty. Our health message was trumpeting concepts that epidemiologists would still be in wonder at 100 years later. So all these opportunities descended and dumped on the church. There was a brief period of peace and prosperity. There was wealth. For a few fleeting moments, nothing seemed to stand in the way. Now, this would not last long. It never does. By 1902, the Russo-Japanese War would propel Japan into a major Pacific power, and just 12 years later, the fearful catastrophe of World War I would fulfill Ellen White's predictions that millions would die and entire navies would go down into the bottom of the ocean. Those predictions of hers made no sense at the end of the 19th century. They made perfect sense in 1915. By the way, back then, she was also warning the world. Human agents are using the most powerful means to, are perfecting the most powerful means to wound and to kill. And she said, hurry up, let the means and the workers be scattered. She added to that, those without God's special protection will have no safety in any place on earth. And back in 1902, when she said that, those words made sense to only two people. One of them was her, this little lady with 3 years of education who just wrote what she was revealed to her in Holy Vision. The other one was a German Jew by the name of Albert Einstein, who was beginning to realize there's enormous power locked in the center of matter, and within 2 years he would publish his famous formula E equals MC squared. Just a few years later, that formula would light the morning sky over Hiroshima. Ellen White wasn't kidding. Hurry, because things are happening that will leave you with no safety any place on earth. So that's the picture in the dawn of the 20th century. Moments of opportunity are moments of particular peril because Lucifer counterattacks. And in 1900, he counterattacked God's message from a direction nobody expected. He counterattacked not from outside, but from within the church. And here's how he did it. By cleverly attacking the unique truths of our message, sanctuary, investigative judgment, and the spirit of prophecy. And his warriors weren't people from outside the church. They were some of the most powerful and respected thought leaders on the inside. Leaders of our medical work, academics, thought leaders, The intelligentsia who got confused on something, now follow me through very clearly on this because it could happen again. They got confused on the nature of God. We get confused on that by whatever terminology we care to apply, emerging truth, emerging church, whatever we may care to call it, you get confused on the nature of God and you go shipwreck. That was going to happen in the Kellogg era. And the attack went like this. You know, maybe we've been wrong about some things. The sanctuary, for example, judgment. God doesn't judge us. Yeah, to say that, you've got to ignore an awful lot of Scripture. But they would say, get real. No one in the whole Christian theological community agrees with us. Investigative judgment, that's just a face-saving explanation for 1844. There was only one problem with that argument. Ellen White had wholeheartedly endorsed the concept of the sanctuary and the investigative judgment. So the next thing you have to do is get rid of Ellen White. And how would you do that? Well, not frontally. You do it very cleverly. Ellen White, oh, bless her heart. She means well. She writes lovely devotional literature, but a prophet? No, not really. You see, there's a little problem with her. She's a plagiarist. Now, I'm not kidding. This stuff was all being said in 1900, 1902, 1904. What is plagiarism, by the way? Isn't that regurgitation of something somebody wrote before? So those who engage it in that are what? Well, anyway, they also added, you know, Ellen White is not a theologian. Well, of course, neither was the Apostle John. He was just a fisherman. Some apostates, like Elder Canright, who was a gifted speaker, who could hold thousands spellbound, took the thing one logical step further, and that was to the Sabbath. They said, you know, that too separates us from other Christian denominations. It's time to rejoin the mainstream. And that's how Lucifer reacted to a moment of opportunity in 1900. Now, was he successful? Well, when this apostasy was over, we had lost the great medical institution in Battle Creek. It burned to the ground. And when it was rebuilt, contrary to the strong counsel of Ellen White, that institution was ultimately lost to Adventism. Today, that magnificent building that Kellogg rebuilt in Battle Creek, that stands ghost-like over the city, you know who owns it? The U.S. government. It's held by the General Services Administration, who stores stuff in it, maybe even pictures of the front of the envelope you mailed. We not only lost our health work, our medical institution, we lost our great publishing house, once the newest and best in Michigan. That burned to the ground because against Ellen White's advice, they had agreed to publish material by Dr. Kellogg that undermined the foundational truths of Adventism and introduced very clever, very appealing, emerging ideas about the nature of God. Now, what does the Bible say? What hath been will be again. What hath been done will happen again. Hold that thought in your mind. When that counterattack at the turn of the century was over, we had lost a whole galaxy of Adventist thought leaders. We lost Battle Creek College. We lost the breakfast cereal industry to apostasy, so that by 1914, just as World War I slammed the door on any quick finishing of God's work, Battle Creek, Michigan was a ghost town as far as Adventism was concerned. There was little there to remind that once it had held the headquarters of the Adventist message. Now, by this time, you're entitled to be asking yourself, why am I taking a few minutes to talk about a 100-year-old misfortune? And let me explain. It's just this. There's a lesson here. In the midst of that apostasy, Ellen White penned a warning. She said, that was the alpha of deadly heresies, but something else would follow it downstream in time. She chose to call that the Omega apostasy, and she said, when it comes, I tremble for our people. In other words, we'd make the whole same mistake again, but we would do it on steroids. Now, let's go back to the 1990s. Glory days of Pax Americana. Soviet Union had collapsed, and when challenged by an adventurous dictator in Iraq, we decimated the fourth largest army on earth in just 100 hours. And everywhere, people looked to America, and suddenly there was an unexplainable surge of wealth. Remember the 1990s? Remember the stock market? As Wall Street took off like a rocket, there was enough money once again to finish the work. An open world, Pax Americana, plenty of money, and for a few fleeting years, that break stood open in enemy lines. Places where we once hardly dared to distribute a Bible were now open. And I wasn't just sitting up front, up near the front in the Moscow church, worried about giving a lady a book. I was in the pulpit speaking. Now, to the brethren's credit, sometimes we have an indoor sport in Adventism where we second-guess the brethren. But to the brethren's credit, they saw that opening and they pushed hard into it. You'll remember those massive evangelistic meetings that took place in previously unenterable countries that had been the Soviet bloc. But it's obvious something went wrong. And how do we know that? Well, we know that because we're still here, aren't we? 13 years into a century that should never have happened, and we traded our Soviet adversaries, who were atheists and who therefore were frightened of death, for a new set of adversaries who welcome it and don't care if they live or die. Who's more dangerous? Something went wrong. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to make a statement that I firmly believe. This afternoon, we should be home. Beyond even the welcoming specter of the sea of glass and the welcome home ceremonies, that should be behind us now. We should be hard at work. Do you realize that our work doesn't end with this world? It just begins. I am convinced that in the world to come, our Lord will expect of us enormous work. How do we guarantee sin doesn't arise again in this cosmos full of free moral agents? Can't you imagine the Redeemed Commission scattered across all of that glittering creation? And when somebody comes to you and says, what's it like to put your mind up against the will of God? You respond, don't even think about it. I've been there, and I'm home now. There is work for us to do. We should be at work now. I think God's plan is to scatter us across the universe, telling and retelling what it's like to be redeemed. Now instead, here we are, beset with a crushing national debt that hints strongly at hyperinflation, threatened by terrorists incomparably more dangerous than our Soviet neighbors ever were, watching a Middle East head toward broadening nuclear capability, and a desperate Israel who now has as a warfighting doctrine something they call the Samson option. Have you heard of it? What happened to Samson? His last final victory was conclusive, but it cost him his life. The Samson option for Israel is, if we go, we're bringing the temple down. And they have at least three German-built, very quiet-running, missile-launching submarines, one of which I understand now has been dispatched by whatever route over into the Arabian Sea. Very, very capable of launching their hardware into the heart of Iran. This thing could get really bad before it gets better. Here we sit, 2013, still waiting, and we ask ourselves, what went wrong? Well, let me go back to the 1990s and the lingering echo of 1900. Look at the parallels. In the 1990s, as in 1900, there was, number one, a suddenly open world, a catastrophically brief period of peace, a clear commission to the church, work while you can because the night's coming when you won't be able to, a sudden out-of-the-blue prosperity, and something goes wrong. The opportunity is missed, and echoing down the corridor of decades is Ellen White's warning, we have now before us the alpha of this danger. The omega will be of a most startling nature. And she added, I tremble for you. Which leads us then, I think if we have an ounce of curiosity, to want to ask, well then, what would the omega challenge look like? A lot of people have ventured to opine on that. I'd rather go back to Ellen White's perspective, because I think she gave us a word picture of what Omega will look like. She did so in a little series of special testimonies. They come in little pamphlet form. She printed these at her own expense. They're called Special Testimonies Series B. Series B, number 7, has her personal description of what she sees as that mysterious future challenge to the church. Let me give it to you in her words. Let me break it down so that these elements are clear. Beginning with her words, the enemy of souls has sought to bring in the supposition that a great reformation was to take place among Adventists, and that this reformation would consist in... Now we're going to go through them element by element. Number one, giving up the doctrines which stand as the pillars of our faith. That's the first one she lists. We start getting confused about what we really believe. Number two, engaging in a process of reorganization. Oh boy, what's embedded in that term? Reorganization can happen a number of ways. It can be explicit. You can have a constituency meeting and the members of the organization vote, we're going to reorganize. That's one way to do it. There is an implicit way you can also reorganize. One is overt, that's open. The other is covert, that's hidden. What would a hidden reorganization look like? Well, if you don't have the votes to get what you want, then you act as if the requirements of the organization really don't matter. You just do what you want anyway. Let me add something here. I said this in the presence of Elder Wilson on that panel discussion. Moderator didn't like it much. He accused me of taking too much time, but I think this is worth a little bit of time. When the world church speaks, we ought to act like a world church and not like autonomous congregationalist entities who can basically do or not do what we want. So number two, she said, we would engage in a process of reorganization, and that can be done implicitly and covertly, as well as through the formal action of the World Church and Assembled General Conference. Point number three, the principles of truth given to the remnant church would be discarded. This really bothered her. She said it three or four different ways, but she kept coming back to that. Giving up the doctrines which stand as the pillars of our faith, the principles of truth would be discarded. Number four, very similar. The fundamental principles that have sustained the work would be accounted as error. So if you hear somebody, however eloquently and superficially persuasive they may seem to be, saying things that lead you away from the clarity of what we have always understood the Advent message to be, just remember where you heard it first. Ellen White saw this coming almost a century before it happened. Fundamental principles that have sustained the work would be accounted as error. Now, number five is interesting. She said books of a new order would be written. In Kellogg's era, it took only one book, his book, Living Temple, to create what she likened to a ship hitting an iceberg. I mean, the work of God just lay dead in the water for a while because we had hit this obstacle. His book, Living Temple, most of it is beautifully written. It's a hymn to life. I've got an original, unexpurgated copy in my library. Later on, when a lot of trouble occurred because of his book, Kellogg had some of the pages, there are just maybe 20, 30 pages that are really troublesome, pulled out of those books, and he resold them. I've got one of the originals with all the pages intact. One book by Dr. Kellogg, Confused on the Nature of God, almost brought this church into a Titanic collision. Now, what's happening today? She said books of a new order. It wasn't singular, it was plural. There would be a blizzard of this stuff coming off various presses, basically challenging the Advent message. Number six, she said the Sabbath would be lightly regarded. Now, think that one through. If the Sabbath is lightly regarded, what also would automatically be lightly regarded? Well, what's the Sabbath a reminder of? Creation! Sabbath, creation. They're two ends of a reversible equation. Mess with one, on the other side of the equal sign, something has to change. You following me? So you get confused on the Sabbath, you lightly regard the Sabbath, you will be strongly tempted on that slippery slope, okay, to now begin to lightly regard what the Sabbath is a reminder of, that's creation. Now once again, let me say it, because I'm a layperson, there are no career implications in this for me, I can say what the Holy Spirit gives me to say. We are a world church, and we should speak like a world church, and that includes our educational institutions. And thank God for a leader like Ted Wilson, who's willing to stand up and defend our biblical view of how this world came to be. You get confused about creation, and you'll automatically come to regard the Sabbath as being relatively unimportant, maybe a culturally interesting artifact of Adventism. Maybe we prefer to get together culturally on Sabbath, but after all, we're all headed to the same place and the day doesn't matter much. That's what Ellen White saw coming. Now think about this. In 1844, two first drafts were written by two men. One of them was named Charles Darwin. In 1844, he wrote the first draft of what would become On the Origin of Species. In 1844, Karl Marx wrote the first draft of what would become Manifesto Comunistической Partei, Communist Manifesto. Now, however confused we may become in postmodern Adventism as to the importance of 1844, which we may be dismissed as a face-saving excuse, there was obviously no doubt in General Lucifer's mind about the importance of that year. Both of those world-changing treatises were first drafted in that very same year. What happens? What happens when you become confused about creation? Well, Karl Marx's theory is that if evolution is correct, if we're continually evolving into a superior species and humankind is the apex of that process of development, then it's axiomatically logical we ought to be able to create heaven on earth through a humanistic, socialistic type of government. Be careful about getting on the slippery slope of creation, because it leads you places you don't even know you're headed. And Ellen White's prediction is that little by little, subtle doubts would come in even to the biblical account as to how we happen to be here, and it would happen from where within God's church. Finally, number seven, major changes in our structure, our literature, our thought. And she said, and I quote now, using her language, Series B, number seven, pages 39 and 40, nothing would be allowed to stand in the way of this new movement, which suggests to me there's political, intentional power behind this attempt to change the church. It isn't happening by accident. This isn't a modification of history. This is an intentional change. Something powerful, something intentional. If the past is any lesson, something cleverly disguised so people wouldn't see it coming. Because she went on to say, the people in Kellogg's era who were trying to foment this type of change within the church, quote, plan how they might gain the sympathies of the people. They would seek to give the impression they believed all the points of our faith and had confidence in the spirit of prophecy. Thus, many would be deceived. So dishonesty as to who you are and what you really believe is also a part of this in the Kellogg era. She says something downstream will happen similar to it. I don't want to go any further than that. Just watch out for what she predicted. A powerful, well-designed plan to mutate the work of God into something he never intended. Now, let me close with a remark which ought to be obvious, but probably needs to be said. All of this is Lucifer's plan to block the church once again at a moment of opportunity. I think it happened in the 1990s. I think Jesus intended to come relatively soon after that opportunity, that opening he gave us. I think we dropped the ball. And when I say we, I mean we. It's altogether too easy to blame the brethren. How have we lived? How have we witnessed? How seriously have we taken the Advent message? So there is out there an end time plan by Lucifer to once again block God's church through an end time challenge. But let me close with the obvious, necessary statement. Ladies and gentlemen, it can only happen if we collectively allow it. Ellen White put it far better than I could. To stand in defense of truth and righteousness when the majority forsake us. To fight the battles of the Lord when champions are few. This will be our test. Thanks and good afternoon.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.AmericanChristianMinistry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.